This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
American workers, business management, and globalization. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, the daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Workers at the auto parts maker Delphi are being asked to take a two-thirds pay cut. Officials of the United Auto Workers have agreed to reduce health benefits hard won from General Motors. In what's called economic recovery, American business leaders say there's much more to come as the phrase world-class pay and benefits takes on new meaning. On To The Point, some say it's all about the globalized economy. Others blame America's way of doing business. Will more companies stop offering health benefits altogether? Will top executives take cuts along with their workers? Does this mean the end of America's prosperous middle class? First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To The Point. For auto assembly line workers, airline pilots, and grocery store clerks, pay and benefit cuts are becoming a fact of life. On To The Point, is it globalization or bad management and a lack of productivity? In the midst of what's supposed to be economic recovery, who's next? First, this news update. While all of Washington is consumed by speculation, there is one place where talk about Karl Rove's possible indictment is forbidden: the Bush White House. Jim Vandehei reports for The Washington Post. Hi, Jim. Good to have you.
Good to be here. How are you doing?
Good. You say in the paper today that there is a surreal silence every morning in the Roosevelt Room. What's that about?
Well, that's when the staff, the high-level staffers meet to talk about the day, to plot out strategy, to figure out what issues they'll be talking about and sort of how to drive their agenda. And one of the issues that everyone's sort of thinking about but never talks about is sort of what's going to happen with Karl Rove and in sort of preparations for life after Karl Rove if he's indicted.
Indicted, of course, in the Valerie Plame leaking case. Very little is known by anybody, I gather, including the people in the White House.
Right. As far as we know, none of them know if Karl is going to be indicted. They're certainly worried that Scooter Libby, who is the chief of staff to the vice president, and Karl Rove, who is, of course, the top strategist to Bush, that both of them could be indicted. They base that mostly on what they're reading in the media and talking to reporters. But remember, a lot of these people have been before the grand jury, and a lot of them are close friends of Karl. So they would probably have some inclination of which way this is headed, though they're not telling us for sure one way or the other.
You report today that Rove and Libby both are part of an innermost circle that has shrunk in the second term. What do you mean by that?
Right. Well, if you think back over the last 3 months, I mean, this was a White House that always, I think, was admired from the outside as a very smooth operating, well-oiled machine. And these last 3 months have not been the finest moment for this presidency. They've had a lot of problems dealing with Iraq, dealing with the federal response to Katrina, high gas prices, and even, you know, the other day when they had that staged event in Iraq that they ended up having to admit, you know, was basically cooked up by some of the communications folks and generally basically a staged event. They've had a lot of problems. And one of the things that we're hearing from folks on the inside and the outside is that there's a lot of fatigue. Staffers like Andy Card, who've been with Bush from the beginning, are burnt out. You know, you go through this process, it's very hard to do it for 2 years, much less, you know, 5 years for some of these folks, and that there may need to be a new infusion of blood at some point after we find out what's up with Rove, or maybe at the beginning of next year when there might be a more obvious transition point.
Well, what then about the scenarios that are being considered in the event that Rove or Libby or both of them are indicted and presumably would have to leave the White House?
Well, the most important one would be Karl, because he's so central to everything that this White House does. You know, people sort of describe him as the central nervous system because he deals with both policy and politics. And listeners might think, well, everybody in Washington deals with both. But not really. You sort of have two different animals. You have those who deal with politics and those who deal with sort of the nitty-gritty of making policy. And what the White House gets from Karl is a good read on what kind of policy they can sell both to the American people but also to Congress and strategy for getting it through. If he were to leave, and again, that's a huge question mark, they would need to bring in somebody with a really sort of sharp political mind. So we hear a lot of people talking about Ed Gillespie, who was a big shot in the re-election campaign, used to be RNC chairman, and has been pulled back in during the judicial confirmation process to help shepherd some of the two nominees through the Senate. Another person is the current RNC chair, Ken Mellman, who used to be political director in this White House. Both guys are very political, but both also have some policy expertise.
Good. We're talking with Jim Vandehei, the White House correspondent for The Washington Post. This is To the Point from PRI. You say that, or you quote, I should say, a former administration, and a lot of people you talk to, of course, don't want to be named for obvious reasons under these circumstances, but you say a former administration official says that people are very demoralized and unhappy for the reasons you've indicated and others as well. What about the president himself?
You know, we don't have any signs, at least outwardly, that he is all that frustrated. He's always a guy who sort of steps back and looks at the big picture. He frequently comments both to us as reporters and to staff about all the hand-wringers in Washington, that people get too caught up in the daily events, and that you have to look at a presidency, you know, by taking a step back and looking at what you've done over a period of months and years and how that will affect the world once you leave. Got to think, though, this is starting to get to him, mostly because when you're consistently at the polls, and the polls at about 39%, and you see that you have conservatives who have been in an unbelievably loyal base for this president from the beginning, when you see those prominent conservatives criticizing you, questioning your judgment, questioning the decisions that you're making internally, it sort of shows that it's not just the partisan frustration, which he's always heard from Democrats, but it's becoming wider and it's spreading. And he's a very sharp political guy himself. Remember his role in his father's presidency in Texas was always considered a real political animal, if you will. So he knows the consequences of all this. So one's got to think that it's starting to weigh on him. But you don't see it. You certainly don't see it in public.
Meantime, of course, once again, all of Washington is waiting for what the special prosecutor will do about the Valerie Plame case. We are, too. And Jim Vandehei, thanks a lot for being with us.
Good to be here. You have a good weekend.
You, too. White House correspondent for The Washington Post. On Reporter's Notebook later, the gun industry wins another big victory. In a moment, American workers, business management, and globalization on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To the Point. America's auto industry once led the manufacturing world, providing high wages, adequate health benefits, and generous pensions. But auto workers are among those getting squeezed out of what's called economic recovery. After looking at General Motors' financial situation, United Auto Workers Union leaders have agreed to $15 billion in health care reductions. Delphi, the auto parts maker, spun off from GM 7 years ago, wants its workers to cut their pay by two-thirds to help the company out of bankruptcy. Peter Morici is former chief economist at the International Trade Commission. He now teaches at the University of Maryland. Welcome to our program.
Nice to be with you.
Why is this happening?
Well, frankly, the UAW's wages and benefits are much more than the market will bear. And when I say that, I don't mean just what other workers earn, but what consumers are willing to pay for General Motors cars. What we've seen over the last 6 months is that General Motors can't sell its cars for enough money to pay those wages and benefits. It's not just the legacy costs. It's not just health care costs. It's the whole panoply, the whole package that they receive.
So is more of this then going to happen, do you think, at GM?
I think so. If you look at companies that go through these kinds of things, concessions tend to lag events. Look at the airline industry. We had successive rounds of concessions, never quite enough. General Motors is losing thousands of dollars per car, saving $1 billion a year. It sounds like a lot of money, but it really isn't.
Well, what about the management of the company, and to what extent is that a part of the problem as well? After all, it was GM that negotiated the contracts.
Well, General Motors and the UAW both share some blame here, but in terms of the management needs to be shaped up as well. It's not particularly efficient. It's widely known to be bureaucratic. It's slow about introducing new models. It has very costly product development processes and time lags and so forth. So the company really needs to be better run. Getting wages down to the level of Nissan and Toyota would be helpful, but the company has to be better run, too.
Nissan and Toyota, do you mean the wages that they pay here in the United States or the wages that they pay in Japan and other parts of the world?
Well, here in the United States, the UAW would actually have to accept wages that are somewhat lower than they pay here in the United States because they don't have the legacy costs in the form of the retiree health care that General Motors has to carry. But the basic problem for the UAW is it hasn't organized other automobile manufacturers in the American South, and also all of manufacturing is laboring under an overvalued dollar and, to some extent, the mishandling of trade policy by the Bush administration.
Going back to the question of the UAW having led the way for American workers in wages and health benefits and generous pensions, there are people saying that this looks like the end of the middle class.
Well, no, I don't think it's the end of the middle class at all, but the middle class has changed. The middle class is increasingly college-educated. Two-thirds of our high school graduates go on to some sort of post-secondary training. The notion that the typical working family is someone in a factory really isn't the case anymore. What it does indicate, though, is that if you pay market wages, you can manufacture in the United States. There are lots of successful manufacturers in the United States, but these misstructured wages, $79 an hour for factory labor, according to General Motors, is just far too much. It's more than the market will bear.
Peter Morici, now at the University of Maryland, formerly with the U.S. International Trade Commission. Harley Shaken is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He specializes in labor and the global economy. Harley Shaken, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What do you say to what's happening here? Is this, as Professor Morici suggests, something that is inevitable and good for the economy or not?
No, I take issue with both. It's neither inevitable nor particularly healthy for the economy. In fact, it's quite damaging. Purchasing power goes down, communities suffer. Some of the most vulnerable people, i.e. retirees, are the ones that take the brunt of this. Let's start with the key issue here. If we look at the most profitable or among the most profitable auto factories in the United States, it would likely be the new United Motor Incorporated partnership of Toyota and General Motors in Fremont, California. That plant pays the highest hourly wage. It has significant legacy cost, and it's a very healthy plant. The reason is quite simple. Consumers want to buy the Toyota Corolla and other products that are assembled in that plant. An important part of GM's problems is they have a car that consumers don't want to buy. Toyota makes a lot of money and pays comparable wages to GM in the U.S., although it doesn't have the legacy costs, which are quite high. But Toyota makes money because consumers pay a premium for Toyota products. GM loses money because GM has to pay consumers to buy their product. Auto wages are at the levels they are today, reflecting decades of rather high productivity in the industry. That productivity continues to increase. And while I think the adjustments that the UAW made, which are significant, were necessary given the context, I think it isn't to say that some mystical market forces mean that auto workers have priced themselves out of the market in the U.S. or that companies cannot be profitable paying high wages in this economy.
Well, if GM has gone into partnership and had developed the most profitable plant in the country in Fremont, California, why can't it do it elsewhere?
Well, I think GM's main problem right now is it has vehicles that consumers just don't want to buy. The Pontiac Aztec, for example. Now, many of your listeners may not know what a Pontiac Aztec looks like. That's because there are very few of them on the street. That car just didn't sell. So no amount of high productivity or low wages is going to make GM profitable in that regard. Now, the company is making some important strides for the future, but this is an industry with long lead times, and some of the previous mistakes are hobbling it now and leading to the losses. Within that context, obviously healthcare is a very significant issue. There's billions of dollars involved in that. But that isn't the cause of the problem, and fixing that alone isn't going to mean GM is a successful firm.
So you say then it's not healthcare alone, it's not globalization, it's bad management?
I think bad management is an important part. There isn't a single smoking gun here. But high healthcare costs or high wages, didn't make GM purchase the Hummer division rather than invest in hybrids as Toyota did. That was a managerial decision that just didn't work given where this economy and where consumers are.
Harley Shaken, a professor at UC Berkeley, back to Peter Morici at the University of Maryland. With regard to Delphi, the auto parts manufacturer asking its workers to take a two-thirds pay cut, it's also at the same time being criticized because of the very high guarantees for its executives, $800,000 to $1 million, in the event that something happens to them. Is that fair?
No, I don't think it's fair at all, and it's absolutely silly. It's really not a matter of what's fair in these discussions. It's a matter of what's realistic. But the Delphi executives have been in a position to know for quite some time now the shape of the company, and if they had better options, they would have left already. The reality is that Delphi doesn't have the very best management, or it wouldn't be in the circumstances that it's in. And rewarding them this way in the, through the bankruptcy process is really not good economics at all.
Again, Delphi has filed for bankruptcy. How is it that executives, what's the mechanism by which they are rewarded, as you just suggested?
Well, you know, they file for bankruptcy, then they ask the judge to provide the top executives with bonuses so they won't leave because their futures are uncertain. I mean, that is an issue that some of them may leave, but who's going to hire these guys right now?
So what then about what we heard from Harley Shaken? If it's not globalization, if it's not healthcare costs completely, why then should workers have to take these cuts?
Well, I think that the workers are overpaid. I disagree with them there. One of the reasons that General Motors can't develop cars is because the money that it has left over after it sells its vehicles for the cost of making them is just not enough to develop cars. Certainly, there's a lot of management problems and there's a lot of inefficiency, but General Motors sells 50% more cars than Toyota does worldwide and has much less for new product development than does Toyota. The plant that it operates jointly with in California is a special case because they're basically using the Corolla design out there, which is developed by Toyota. You know, if Toyota would give General Motors products to manufacture, it could pay $79 an hour, perhaps. But General Motors just doesn't have enough money left over after it pays these kinds of wages.
Harley Shaken, back to you at UC Berkeley. There's been some reporting today about some of the details of this deal made with the UAW and General Motors. And as I understand it, according to the Associated Press, right now, United Auto Workers pay nothing for health care coverage. Under this deal, they'd have to pay $752 annually in deductible copayments and monthly premiums. That's still a pretty good deal, isn't it?
The health care that auto workers will have, and this is retirees we're talking about, while the cuts are painful for people on fixed incomes, there's no question about that, the package they wind up with after the cuts remains among the best for workers in this country. I'd have to say it's probably somewhat comparable to what members of Congress earn in retirement in terms of health care. But I think this highlights a larger issue. Healthcare is not something we should be dealing with at the bargaining table. No other industrial country in the world does that. It puts an unreasonable burden on bargaining, creates a lot of conflicts, and makes companies less competitive. So that's a failure of not having national health insurance. And also, I didn't mean to imply that globalization isn't an issue. I believe very much it is an issue. That is, wages elsewhere are having in manufacturing an enormous impact on wages on U.S. manufacturing firms, particularly in auto. But that said, it's neither just globalization nor healthcare that's at the core of GM's problems right now. There are other issues that also need to be addressed for the firm to become more competitive.
Talking with Harley Shaken at the University of California at Berkeley and Peter Morici at the University of Maryland. This is To the Point from PRI. So let's be more specific, Harley Shaken. What are the things that need to be dealt with in addition to healthcare, which you just mentioned, and which could make American companies both more competitive and still allow them to pay significant wages, provide health benefits and retirement as well?
Well, I think the companies need to address two basic issues, and public policy, that is Washington, needs to address two basic issues. For the companies like General Motors, it means products that consumers want to buy, some advanced thinking about where the market's going, like hybrids versus Hummers. second, higher productivity and quality. And here, the unionized workforce can be central. You have an older workforce. You have highly skilled people in that workforce. The union works with the company, which the UAW very much wants to do in this area, then that productivity and quality will be forthcoming, provided tensions over collective bargaining don't impact it. On a policy level, I think we really need to look hard at health insurance, national health insurance. It isn't just something right since we have 45 million uninsured Americans, that it is. It's something that U.S. manufacturing, what's left of it, needs to be competitive. And second, we really have to look at realistic trade policies that take into account the new dynamics of the global economy. That doesn't mean retreating into protectionism. We can have an internationalist vision. Expanded trade is potentially very healthy, but we need core labor rights as a central part of trade agreements. Otherwise, if workers in China can't form a union and are forced to accept not market wages, but whatever they are compelled to work for, then workers in Flint and Saginaw and Detroit are going to feel the impact of that. Our trade agreements right now, when it comes to labor issues, are rooted in the 19th century. We've made steps in terms of intellectual property rights or in terms of a whole range of other corporate issues. We've left labor to the sidelines or out altogether. That's not going to work in a competitive global economy.
A lot of issues to deal with here in a very short time. Peter Morici, back to you. Why is it that the companies in the American automobile industry have not been supportive of national health care?
Well, I think you need to ask them directly, but business is generally ambivalent about creating yet another large government bureaucracy. I mean, consider what it's like to deal with some government agencies. Do you really want those folks running the hospitals? But Harley really does touch on some important issues. We pay 50% more for health care in the United States, the price we pay for health care, than the Europeans do. It's not so much that it's provided by the government or provided by the private sector, but the reality is they regulate the prices of pharmaceuticals. We don't. And the Bush administration has taken us further down the road of higher drug prices with its drug plan. With regard to exchange rates, the Bush administration has been blind to facts and deaf to reason and just frankly has not taken on China in a manner that's meaningful or relevant. And we need to take a hard look at the trade laws. The trade laws are under attack by all of our trading partners. We do need to defend those laws so that we can defend American workers and businesses from subsidized, dumped, unfair competition. The Bush administration has been ambivalent about that as well. I mean, manufacturing generally hasn't been getting the kind of support it needs from our government in quite some time.
We will be back in just a moment after a very brief break. We're talking with Peter Morici at the University of Maryland's Robert H. Smith School of Business and with Harley Shaken at the University of California. We will talk with other guests as well, and we'll come back to that question of health care very particularly. On Reporter's Notebook, the National Rifle Association claims a historic victory. We'll hear about a new law shielding gun makers and sellers from lawsuits. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're not only back with To the Point, talking today about the wage cuts and benefit cuts now facing American workers in the automobile industry, sort of a bellwether for the rest of the economy, although I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of industries have already undergone the same kinds of changes that the United Workers auto workers are doing now. They just have among the best contracts of any industry in the United States. So we've talked a bit about health insurance, which we will come back to. We've talked about trade policy. Also raised was the question of producing better products. Jessie Scanlon is our next guest. She's editor of Business Week's online publication, Innovation and Design. And Jessie Scanlon, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Your organization, as I understand it, is looking into the impact of the design of both products and services on a business. And you're looking at this question of how you go about producing products that people want to buy and how you reorganize your business to do that. What have you found?
Certainly. Well, I mean, we launched the site because we felt that globalization was squeezing profit margins. There was increased competition, hyper-efficient manufacturing operations, streamlined supply chains. They weren't guaranteeing success in the way that they had in the past. Technology had become almost a commodity, being outsourced to Bangalore and places in China. So companies really do have to move beyond those sort of Six Sigma principles and look at how to create, as Harley said, how to create products that consumers really want. And that involves both product design, creating things like the iPod, that are beautiful, people love them. But in fact, that's actually it's more than creating a wonderful product. It's creating something that really changes the way you experience music. It's really almost more of a service. Netflix is a wonderful example of a new service that just changes the way you experience movies or experience renting movies. Starbucks is sort of the penultimate example of a coffee company that really doesn't sell coffee. They always say that, they sell the experience of going in there and sitting in the easy chair and reading the paper for a few hours. So all these are examples of companies that really sort of looked at the market, looked at the competition, and decided they weren't really going to compete on the existing terms. They were going to create a new kind of model. So they weren't going to try to sell coffee. Starbucks was going to sell an experience. Apple isn't going to sell a music player. It's going to sell a new way to experience music. And that's the sort of shift that we're seeing.
You said you started out dealing with the issues of globalization, and one of its benefits is said to be keeping down the costs of a product. When products are approached in the way that you suggest, does that allow companies to sell them at a price that allows them also to pay good wages, better wages than are paid in the rest of the world, and to provide benefits both in terms of health and retirement?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm no experience on labor policy. I will say that right now our other guests are much more experts in that area. But I think you certainly can look at something like Whole Foods, a grocery store, which has very progressive labor policies. They pay much higher than many other grocery stores. It's an industry with razor-thin margins. And what they've done is, been wonderful at organizing all their employees into teams, investing them with a lot of authority and power to change how they sell apples or how they organize the store. They hire somebody. 1 month later, all the employees on that team that they work for actually vote whether or not to keep that employee on. They have a set limit. The highest paid employee can only be paid a certain amount more than the lowest paid employee. So there you really see an example of a company that's been able to create a new experience, a new way of going into a grocery store and shopping for food, and also treat their employees well.
Jessie Scanlon, editor of Business Week's online publication, Innovation and Design. Let me go back to our other guests on this. Harley Shaken, first to you, University of California at Berkeley. Are these the kinds of things that can help to make the American economy more competitive?
Oh, I think very much so. I think the whole notion of producing not simply what meets an existing demand, but creating new demand can be very important. I think constant innovation puts a premium in some cases on location, that is, having the manufacturing or the service here. In some cases, the service has to be here. Starbucks is going to be in San Francisco for consumers here, no matter what wage costs are elsewhere. But that said, I think we also have to look at the manufacturing dimension of this and look at making sure that the manufacturing firm also has labor policies in place that really work well, not just for their cost, that's critical obviously, but also in terms of people being able to be part of the middle class. And here we go back really to the most famous example of all, the first Henry Ford, with the car people wanted, the Model T, the assembly line, the very productive technology. He didn't cut wages in half. He doubled them in January of 1914. And the alchemy of that is the price of the car went down, wages went up, and profits of the Ford Motor Company went up by 20%.
Let me go back to Jesse Scanlon. You said labor policy wasn't your strong suit, and I understand that. But what about translating the kinds of imaginative innovation and design that you talked about earlier with regard to Whole Foods and Apple computers and so on into the automobile business? Have you looked at that possibility? How about Ford magazine, Ford Motor Company? Are they moving in that direction?
You know, I'm so sorry. I'm really going to have to pass the buck on this one.
Sure. That's perfectly all right. And we didn't get a chance to talk ahead of time, so I fully understand that. Let me go back to Peter Morici at the University of Maryland. What about it? We haven't asked you yet about these kinds of changes in the way that American companies operate. Are they translatable into heavy manufacturing, such as with automobiles?
Well, in terms of the workplace and being innovative in the workplace, American mini mills have done very well in the steel sector. By adopting those kinds of practices. It's hardly anything new to them, and they avoided some of the problems of integrated mills and pay very good wages. One of the sad things is that Ford and General Motors have been very conservative in their product design, and they haven't been nearly forward-looking enough. Same thing with Chrysler. That's why Honda and Toyota were out there first with hybrid vehicles. They saw the future better. Also, if you're going to have a very innovative workplace, often unions can be a barrier to accomplishing that because it puts the negotiator between the workers and the management, and the union has to justify itself by negotiating work rules and a contract and so forth. Another thing is when we talk about innovative products, they tend to be upper-end, more expensive products. Poor folks weren't the first ones to buy iPods, for example. And for a lot of your mass appeal products, another one is Whole Foods. You don't see people with moderate incomes at Whole Foods. You see basically upper-income professionals. I go there, and you can see that quite readily. So there are a lot of problems in trying to generalize these notions out to all that we do. I mean, you know, Starbucks, they don't have to compete with imports.
Harley Shaken, back to you on this point. Are these innovative products then pretty much available at the upper end of the economy, not necessarily anywhere else?
No, I don't think that has to be the case. I think Peter's making a good point that it often is at the upper end, but it just doesn't have to be there. The Model T example, the whole genius of the Model T was making the automobile available to ordinary working people. If we look today, Costco, that has a mass base of consumers. There are other places where there's a lot of innovation for just everybody, and I think that's very much possible and really an area where there could be some important success. On the issue of having unions, I think some of the most innovative work organization in the country is in unionized facilities, whether it's in NUMMI, the GM-Toyota partnership we were talking before in Fremont, or at the General Motors Saturn plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee. There's a lot of new approaches out there that are very productive and that really integrate the knowledge, the skill, the know-how of workers into the whole process. So there are untapped possibilities out there, but they're going to be very necessary, combining it on the product side and on the production side for U.S. firms to be competitive.
Arlie Shaken at UC Berkeley. I said earlier we would talk about healthcare in greater depth. So let me introduce Dr. Rick Brown. He's director of the Center for Health Policy Research at UCLA, also a professor there in the School of Public Health, former consultant to President Clinton's Task Force on National Healthcare Reform, and past president of the American Public Health Association. Dr. Brown, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren. It's good to be with you.
We heard earlier about the idea of national health insurance. We're also hearing more and more about a switch from what's called defined benefit health plans to defined contribution plans. Rather than talking about national health care at the moment, what about this shift and what does it mean?
Well, it fundamentally means that we have been moving from a situation of, as you said, defined benefits in which the employer or the government program, such as Medicare or Medi-Cal or Medicaid, says to you, you're going to get these benefits, these health benefits, and the government will manage the health care costs, or the employer will manage the health care costs and any increases in costs. We're going to be responsible for that. When we move to defined contribution, that changes, and the employer or government says you will get a fixed money contribution for health benefits from us, but then you're going to have to manage the costs and any cost increases. In effect, what they're saying is we have tried to manage health care costs. We've done a lousy job at it. And now we're going to turn the job over to you, the individual consumer, the individual family, and make you be responsible for any increases in those costs and have to deal with them.
Would this create a situation where if somebody has a heart operation and decides to pay for it and then later on gets cancer, they might not have enough money left to cover it?
Well, it very much depends on the kind of plan that they have. And one of the most worrisome things that I think we see emerging out of all of these changes going on is what we call the high-deductible health plans, sometimes also called consumer-directed health care. And what that fundamentally means is that you get a catastrophic plan, usually with a pretty substantial deductible and a large share of the costs for services when you need them. And you are responsible for those very large costs. Those are not small costs, but the notion is that somehow they bring the premiums down. It's important to note that these plans are not cheap. For example, nationally, for a 20-year-old, the average cost of one of these plans for an individual is $100 a month. For a 20-year-old who wants a family coverage plan, it's over $200 a month. And if you're 55, it's a lot more than that. And when you add up all of the financial exposure of the individual worker, the individual, and the family, these can be very high. For example, for a 55-year-old who has a family, and let's say there are two people both around that age, two spouses, and maybe they have a child, their out-of-pocket costs could be as high as $16,000 a year for the premium, the deductible, and the share of cost if they both had significant illnesses. That's enough to bankrupt almost any family that has low or moderate income.
You said employer or government, and I understand that in Florida, the Bush administration has approved Medicaid changes that would incorporate the kind of thing that you are talking about. What's the difference between this and health rationing?
Well, it's a form of health rationing. We do health rationing every day when we make people have to decide between putting food on the table or buying medical care. But in this case, we are taking a population of very poor people. People in Medicaid are by definition poor. And we're saying to them in Florida, as one possibility, you could opt out of the regular Medicaid program and get a voucher that you'd use to go and buy health insurance with no real protection from the government as to what that plan might cover, what kinds of standards for cost sharing it might have, or any of those things. Serious risk for that kind of a family.
Dr. Rick Brown at UCLA. Peter Morici, back to you, formerly with the U.S. International Trade Commission and now at the University of Maryland. Is this the kind of thing that we're going to see across the economy?
I think we're going to see more of it. Firms have been unable to provide health care on a sort of open-ended basis to employees without the cost being too large, so they're looking for ways to save money. One of the things that bothers me about sending employees out to...
We seem to have lost Peter Morici. Don't know why that is. We'll try to get him back. Meantime, Harley Shaken at UC Berkeley, you still with us?
I sure am.
Your comment on what appears to be a new way of providing health insurance on a sort of rationed basis.
Oh, I think it's really going backwards. I think it conflicts with core American values, that is, that we should have some basic rights when it comes to health care. The notion that children should suffer if their parents lose a job and don't have access to private health care because the government now is rationing it in new ways, I think really, really challenges some long-held values that have been implicit in what we might call a social contract between people in this country, and employers, and the government. And this takes us backwards.
You were an advisor to Dr. Brown, you were an advisor to the president's task force during the Clinton years. They stepped away from the idea of national health care. Do you think that what we're hearing about will, in fact, increase pressure to take another look at it?
Well, I think down the line it will. I think one of the things it will engender is at last a real national debate about where we ought to go with our health care system. As Peter noted, we pay 50% more per person in this country than our European allies do and for our health care. And yet we are getting so little for it. I think that what this new direction toward these very high deductible health plans, the consequence of that will be felt by people in a few years. And as it is felt, there will be a large debate about whether this is a tolerable situation and whether people have to continue to experience this erosion of their standard of living, especially in the healthcare area where it is so essential to the opportunities of all families and individuals, or whether we will move toward a system that says we do have a common good that we need to protect and a common standard of living that all people should be able to have, even if they don't have the cash income to buy it in the marketplace.
Dr. Rick Brown, again at UCLA. Back to Peter Morici at the University of Maryland. We have got him back with us, again, formerly with the U.S. International Trade Commission. So much talk about health care costs. Do you think that politically it's feasible to have at this point the kind of debate, conversation that Dr. Rick Brown is calling for? Have we reached that point where it's going to seem so crucial to so many people that they're going to have to re-examine a lot of political verities, that, or at least things that have seemed to be political verities for a long time?
Well, I think we've reached the point where we should be doing it. I don't think we've reached the point that we can, because I don't think we have the right cast of actors in Washington right now to get it done, to be very honest. I think that we need to be very cautious. I was getting back earlier about, you know, not taking care of older people as well as young people. One of the real barriers to employing people between the ages of 50 and 65 is their health care costs are expensive. They impose a heavy burden on group plans, but they're not yet ready for Medicare. Perhaps the way to begin is by extending Medicare southward in terms of age and providing a way of keeping those people in the labor force longer. And the other thing we're going to have to decide is we're going to have to put a floor under health care that everybody can enjoy. But I think it's foolish to believe the way American society is set up that we can have the same level of service for everyone. There's going to be sort of an entry-level tier that everyone gets, and then there's going to be another tier of service that those who are more affluent get. We don't like to talk about that,
But unless we address that, we're not going to get this done.
All right. Grim possibilities ahead, very possibly, but maybe we can ultimately work all this out. We're thankful to all of you for being with us today. Peter Morici at the University of Maryland, Dr. Rick Brown at UCLA, Harley Shaken, a professor at University of California, Berkeley, and Jesse Scanlon, editor of Business Week's Innovation and Design Online. Glad to have all of you with us. We'll come back, talk about these subjects again in the future. This is To the Point from PRI. Dozens of lawsuits are likely to be thrown out of court when President Bush signs a bill sent to him yesterday by Congress. Shooting victims and families have sued gun makers and sellers who will now be sheltered by federal law. In a moment, more on what the National Rifle Association calls a historic victory on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the Point, all one word, .com.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Wisconsin's Republican Congressman James Sensenbrenner says lawsuits charging gun makers and sellers with criminal negligence are brazen attempts to accomplish through litigation what can't be done through the legislative process. So the new law will be retroactive without providing any relief for plaintiffs who are already in court. John Russo is the city attorney of Oakland, California, one of 12 cities and counties in California who had suits against the industry in state courts. So those cases, however, have already been dismissed. John Russo, good to have you with us.
Yes, thank you very much. Nice to be with you today.
If already there has been a dismissal of these cases in the state court in California, what impact will the federal law have?
Well, I think there's a couple of things here. I think this is really an issue of corruption. And there's two aspects to the corruption. One is the one that we all understand, that this is a Republican-dominated Congress and that the politicians in Washington do what they call pay to play. The NRA gives a lot of money. The gun manufacturers give a lot of money. Now they get special treatment. This law by the Congress, though, is even more dangerous, not just because of guns, but because of the attack on our very American system of federalism. For over 200 years, state law has been the way issues that have to do with criminality, issues that have to do with product safety, business practices, all of those things have been dealt with at the state level. This is now the second time in this calendar year that this Congress has divested state law and invested federal law, Big Brother, into the court systems of our 50 states. And I think it's a very dangerous trend.
Hasn't in the past one of the reasons that the federal government has been asked to extend its authority been that in many states they've been reluctant to establish such things as product liability laws?
Well, I think that's the case. I mean, the irony here is that many of the people who are supporting this law that just passed that creates the gun industry as a favored industry are the same people and the same philosophic bent, supposedly, that 30 years ago, 40 years ago, were saying that, yes, civil rights is a good idea, but Washington shouldn't get involved and deal with local control. It really seems to depend on who's paying the freight here. And what it looks to me that Congress has done is, in effect, they sold an indulgence to the gun industry. There's no avoiding that conclusion. Why should guns be exempted from the normal state judicial process any differently than anything else? You would think that things like healthcare professionals, you can have an argument about that because you say, well, you know, doctors, nurses, they're generally doing something that we all agree is a good. Maybe there. But when you start saying we're going to take this one industry and the rules that apply to you and me in our personal lives and in our business lives, that this one industry is not going to be held responsible for its actions, that's bizarre.
John Russo, once again, is the city attorney of Oakland, California, one of 12 cities and counties in California who have had lawsuits against the gun industry. Now, your cases were dismissed. Let me ask you to respond to Congressman Sensenbrenner, who said that there should be no such lawsuits in the first place. Why should there be?
Well, why should there be? I mean, I'm not going to sit here now and give sort of the gun control argument one side or the other. I don't think that's the point of this law. I think the burden falls on the Congress to explain why the gun industry of all industries should be exempted from the laws that apply to all of us. And those are laws that have to do with ultra-hazardous activities, has to do with false marketing, has to do with product liability. If, in fact, the federal government can overrule state law for one industry, an industry that happens to donate heavily to the majority of this Congress, if they can do that, then why do we have states at all? I mean, at some point, it's all going to be up for sale in Washington, and that's what it appears to be. I think that's the danger here.
You may not want to talk about gun control, but apparently the Congress did. Certainly Congressman Sensenbrenner did. That was the impact of his statement. So can't you just give us one idea of why it is that the gun manufacturers, contrary to what the Congress is making national policy, presuming the president signs it, why should that not be policy on a policy basis rather than the rather procedural basis you're arguing?
No, I guess the point I'm making is states should – I mean, our system of government is that the states create their own laws in
right.
this area. And California, for example, has made its decisions – decisions are always best made closest to the people. That's what the founders of this nation said. Every issue that should be – that is not taken up by the feds should be left to the states, and we've generally given that a great deal of respect and latitude. California made decisions about this. The lawsuit that you're talking about that was – the Oakland's lawsuit that was dismissed with the other cities, California state courts examined our theory, which was a unfair trade practices theory, and dismissed it. The states were able to take care of this claim on their own terms. We don't need Big Brother federal government picking and choosing which industries laws don't apply to.
Okay. Once again, the president now has the option to sign the bill. He has indicated that he will. We'll come back, talk about it on later programs. John Russo, again, city attorney of the city of Oakland. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, and Sherman Rimbaum. Managing producer, Cameron Redziner. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.